Getting to know you, getting to know all about you, getting to like you, getting to hope you like me, getting to know you, putting it my way but nicely. You are precisely my cup of tea. Getting to know you, getting to feel free and easy. When I am with you, getting to know what to say. Haven't you noticed? Suddenly I'm bright and breezy because of all the beautiful and new things I'm learning about.
Welcome to Broadway Radio. It's this week on Broadway for Sunday, August 21st, 2016. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast today we have Peter Felicia. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His most recent is The Great Parade, which is available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Masterworks, Broadway, Broadway Select, and many other places. Hello, Peter.
Hello.
Michael is vacationing at the Jersey Shore this week, but he will be back next week. But we have a little special episode for you today where we're going to talk with Bart Scherr and Ted Chapin from Rodgers and Hammerstein.
Getting to know you, getting to feel free and easy.
With us today, we have a very special guest. Bart Scherr is joining us. Broadway fans know Bart from directing many different projects. I want to say starting all the way back in 2005 with Light in the Piazza, then Awaken Sings, South Pacific, Joe Turner's Come and Gone, Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown, Golden Boy, The Bridges of Madison County, The King and I, the revival at Lincoln Center that just passed, and Fiddler on the Roof in Oslo. So, Bart, thank you so much for joining us. We very much appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to let us know what's going on.
Thank you. It's great to have a chance to chat.
So you are gearing up for a national tour of The King and I, and we just wanted to touch base with you because we're doing a show that especially focuses on The King and I, so we wanted to talk with you about that and kind of get your take on when you remount a production such as the revival of The King and I that was just closed at Lincoln Center, a highly successful production, and now you're going to put out a national tour. Are you looking to sort of go further with the same concept or try to replicate as best as possible you can the Lincoln Center experience or develop it further? What's your take on that?
Uniquely, because we did this originally in the Beaumont Theater, I have one very giant job of adjusting it from a thrust into a proscenium. So most of my immediate work is to take the idea of the design and push it into a different box. So that's kind of a very technical problem. I'm comfortable on a thrust especially, and I love proceniums as well. So it's just a big adjustment because it's quite a big show. It's an epic show. And it needs that. I think what makes The King and I special and relevant today is you know, on a very, you know, fundamental level, is this sort of notion of change among, you know, leadership and among leaders as to how they can face actually transitioning or transforming in the face of new ideas, new things, new everything. And so you have a king in Siam who meets this woman and his entire kingdom is under siege, and he has to move from a very traditional culture to a new one. So those basic ideas hold, but I explore them in different ways each time. So, and with different people, and then different people bring new things to it. But the basic questions and the way I want to ask them remain the same.
All right. Now you mentioned big. Is that big boat traveling with you?
Yes, the big boat in a perhaps maybe smaller version is traveling with us as well. Mm-hmm. It can't happen in the same way because of the nature of the Beaumont, but yeah, we are going to have a boat. Yeah.
All right. One of the most amazing experiences I've had in the last few years was seeing Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown in London. Now, it had your name on it. It had your name on it. You directed it there, right?
Well, this I did. I directed. Well, I wasn't happy with what happened in New York.
This is what's so amazing to me. This is what's so amazing to me, that it was a completely different production, had no bearing on the other one. It seemed to me I was watching No Sex, Please, We're British, interrupted by songs. And I thought that was a very successful way of handling it. And the audience had a wonderful time. So so what's it like when you say to yourself, you know, I've got to face the facts that I've got to try it a different way. Did you come to that reluctantly? Did somebody come to you and say, Bart, do it differently? What happened?
No. Had anybody been there as we were trying to open a new musical on Broadway, they would have been very clear that we needed to keep working. and no one had any problem telling us how much they hated it or didn't like it or whatever. That was no problem. I just didn't think it was really ready. And there were many, many questions that I hadn't answered properly the first time. So it was really, I was responding to my own process. It just didn't feel complete as an experience. And because Ambassador Theatre Group was willing to give it a shot, we did a couple of workshops in London, and we got Tamsin Gregg, who's an incredible actress, and Hayden Gwynn, who's also great. Yes, and we built a show there in a very different confines. And also the property for Jeffrey Lane and David Yazbek, I wanted to make one that was more playable for somebody else, because the first one was just too hard for anyone else to direct.
Mm-hmm. I can appreciate that.
It was pretty intense. So.
All right. Looking at your resume, we see almost as many plays as musicals. Where does your heart lie? How did it all start for you? Did it start with the musical theater, or did it start with so-called straight theater?
No, I started with plays. I grew out of more of a pure language tradition than an experimental tradition and a classical tradition. So I studied at the Guthrie Theater under Garland Wright, which was a thrust where I learned a lot, and then built up from there and worked in, you know, I directed over 20 Shakespeare's and most of the great writers in the Western European canon. I studied African theater in England. I've studied plenty of Asian theater. So I really was exploring theater like mid-20th century, great directors like Strehler, Tadeusz Kantor was a big influence, and they were driving me. And then I eventually was led a bit more into musicals and opera a bit later in my career.
And what was the first, do you recall, the first musical you ever did and where it was?
Oh, I did musicals very early on when I first started directing, and a little bit all the way along the way, but I didn't really come to that on the scale of something like Light in the Piazza. I'd done Three Penny Opera, I'd done Working was one I did, and things like that. But I didn't really see myself as a person. I didn't see myself in any category at all. I just was building my chops, my work, my muscularity as a director in verse, spoken, experimental theater, and then sort of brought me eventually to musical theater.
Well, in terms of a category, it seems to me that you're extraordinary, because in that Fiddler on the Roof production, I'd seen the show 17 different productions before I saw yours, and looking at it and seeing how Seidel is so upset when Yenta shows up, I thought, whoa, that's right. This is exactly right. This is where her whole world is disappearing. It seems to me that you must be a director who looks at every syllable and says, okay, let's really think what's going on here.
Well, yeah, but if you actually really think about it, almost every plot since, you know, the Greeks is based on a father forcing a daughter to marry somebody she doesn't want to. I mean, like, including all of Shakespeare, Terence, most of the commedias, Pantalone, Moliere. It's always about the ownership of the father of the daughter and the struggle between love. And when I saw when I was looking at Fiddler, I just felt like the tradition of doing Matchmaker in such a carefree way and sort of tossing the brooms around made no sense to me of the text on a pure level, just no sense. So we did slow it down a little bit, which was hard to do with the song. The song didn't want to go as slow as we started, but from a plot point of view, it's three plots about all three girls don't want to marry the person dad wants them to marry. And if we're going to get off on the right foot, I figured we had to really dig in on the first one. So. Mm-hmm.
All right, two smash hits with Rodgers and Hammerstein shows. Did R&H come to you? Did you go to them and say, I want to do this? Was it Andre Bishop? What happened?
Well, I had directed Light in the Piazza with Adam Gettle, who was Oh, you know, right. The grandson of Richard Rogers. Yeah. And that helped, I think, a little bit. When they came around to, Andre had wanted to do South Pacific for a long time. Mary Rogers, really, we got along incredibly well, and she was an amazing woman. And they sort of felt like it was the right time. And the good fortune of, I love the script. Again, that was one of those ones where I was very, very moved by the book when I read it. I thought as a piece of writing, there were some great scenes in there, and there's a lot of ways of looking at them that maybe people hadn't. I don't think about it that way, but I said, look at that. That's amazing. I mean, I just thought it was really great writing. So Andre had always wanted to do it, but because of Piazza and because Mary, it all kind of came together at the right way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Good.
So tell us about Bridges to Madison County. It had been worked on for so many years. When was your introduction to it?
I think there had been one workshop when Kelly said, would I be interested in doing it? And I got to meet – Kelly was working on it before I was. And I met Jason and Marsha, and we started working out. We did like 3 or 4 workshops and then finally put it up. I really loved it. It's a tricky thing in a commercial environment because it's not the greatest date play to go to, you know, like mm-hmm. take somebody on a really hot date and then see this play about adultery. So maybe that wasn't in our favor. Mm-hmm. But I did really love the emotional sound of the music and telling the story. I wasn't a huge fan of the book. But I didn't really take it on the merits of the book. I just took it on the merits of what we've written. So it was fun.
And then you work on it again from a different perspective for the tour, or because it's a great
No, the tour was really a reproduction of the one here. That was a very not carbon copy, but it had already been in a proscenium. It didn't need much adjustment. We used much of the original set and then built it from there because I was quite happy with that one. It was, unlike something like Women on the Verge, which was just overproduced and I thought it out too hard and did too much, that needed more work to be sort of distilled into something purer, whereas Bridges was in pretty good shape by the time we'd open in New York. And whether it was a huge commercial success was separate from whether it was a good production. It was a great production. So.
All right. Now here you have a new hit, Oslo, which is coming to Broadway yeah. after this successful run. Now this is a pretty yeah. heady yet funny play. Yeah. And was it brought to you? Did you find it? What?
That's pretty interesting. I actually met Mona Jewell, who is one of the Norwegian diplomats, in front of my daughter's school in when our daughters went to the same, were in the same second grade class at Chapin School in New York City. So I met them there. I did a play with JT called Blood and Gifts, and we brought Taya Rod Larson, the other diplomat, in to talk to the cast because he'd been one of the major negotiators, in the Middle East. And, his stories about Oslo and about the Middle East were so amazing. And I just thought this could be an interesting play. And JT agreed. We sort of he really could smell it too. So we began this journey of putting together Oslo. It's funny. I really think Oslo is much more, if anything, more of a comedy than strangely mm-hmm. a comedy mm-hmm. that is mm-hmm. kind of a happy ending than it mm-hmm. is. It's heady because people think, oh my God, why am I going yep. to a play about Middle East peace negotiations?
Sure.
But their behavior and the stories, the reason we were compelled, the stories Taya would tell about the way this stuff all happened is so incredibly outrageous.
I agree.
That if you, you know, so we thought it would really make good theater. So.
Good.
At any point, were you concerned with Oslo being 3 hours and 2 intermissions?
I was concerned, you know, there's a very, very great story about Robert Evans when Coppola brought him the first cut of The Godfather, and Robert Evans wisely said to him, it's too short. I had to make Oslo as long as it is. I think by the time we still feel like we need to cut it a bit more before we get to Broadway. It comes in 3 distinct sections, which have to do with how it's upgraded. So I felt we should leave it in 3 with 2 intermissions. It felt more the old fashioned structure, but it's good. And then now the way people watch television now is literally it's in 40 minute segments based on how many times you watch, you know, if you can sit and watch Game of Thrones in an entire afternoon, the whole season. Mm-hmm. And I think audiences are shifting in their ability to kind of, and it's easier to give them a little bit of refreshing with two intermissions than it is to say, you know, stick it out all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
So I just let it be the structure it was, and it felt the most honest structure for each new character coming in as we went along. And we'll still keep working on that when we get to the Broadway version of the
story. You can go to the marketing meetings for the Broadway production and say, you do a marketing campaign, binge watch Oslo.
Yeah, it's kind of, that's actually a really good idea. I'm going to remember that, I swear to God. It's that kind of, I look at it like that, you know, like, I mean, actually maybe I'm more likely to binge watch the, you know, Great British Bake Off, but also you're going to binge watch, because I love that show. I watch that with my daughters, or watch, you know how you do that now? We like watch four in a row.
Yeah.
Or five in a row, or six, because we, you know, and it's actually kind of calms you down and makes you kind of, is a nice way to pass. I think that's the way of thinking about it also, because it's quite entertaining, and mm-hmm. it takes a lot of turns, and it's a bit like an intellectual mm-hmm. thriller.
Mm-hmm.
So that seems kind of fun.
Totally tangential. I have an 8 and a 13-year-old, and they loved the Great American British Bake Off.
Isn't it great? Oh my God, it's so good.
It's so strange that my kids are so interested in that.
Well, you know what I believe about those shows is I think people like seeing people be good at things.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
and they like
brilliant.
The science
yeah.
of it. You know, they like seeing how it goes together. So, you know, because I have a 7 and a 15-year-old, and they can watch it for hours, and yeah. then they'll go in and try stuff, and they see how hard it is. It's a little bit like sports or something. It used to be that way with Project Runway, you know.
With Oslo being, when I went to go see Oslo, all of us on Broadway Radio gave Oslo a rave. And when I went to go see it, it was an especially long day for me. And I was thinking to myself, oh, my goodness, it's an 8 o'clock show and it's 3 hours long. And it's about the topic. And I'm like, I totally went in not in a great frame of mind. And I came out like at midnight energized, heading home and raving about this show. And so at any point, did everybody in the production say, you know, how do we cut this thing? Or is it just, it was everything too sacred to be cut?
We have almost 4.5 hours of material. There's so many stories.
Yeah.
The real issue was, and first preview came down, you know, it started 11, first preview was 3.5 hours long.
Mm.
So we cut 35 minutes from it.
Wow.
So it's just that, the thing was always true about it. Like these shows that work, the thing that's great about them is that they always work. The ones that don't work are the ones that didn't ever really work. It's
all
very
right,
hard to show the other way.
But,
you know, and this one had always had this great energy to it.
But always. You must have lost something. Did you say, I hate to lose that, but we're going to have to. What was the thing that was hardest to part with in those 35 minutes?
There was one scene. There's one scene. You know, we had many, many scenes, and we had a couple of airport scenes and a couple of other things that were very funny. Like, cause when they first arrived in Norway, of course, it was all secret. So nobody knew it. And they were horribly searched and terribly exposed, and they were furious and they couldn't believe it. And everywhere they went, they're screaming at Terry. And those were pretty fun scenes, but probably the one that gets me the most is that, when Perez calls and says, you know, you have to go meet me in Stockholm. They had no reason to go to Stockholm, and they had to lie, basically tell a story, not lie, they don't lie, tell a story to the Swedish authorities because they what you don't know is that the Norwegians provide heavy water to Israel to make their nuclear weapons.
Uh-huh.
So they made up a whole story to the Swedish government that they were going in to renegotiate this contract. And then went into the royal palace and under their noses negotiated a, you know, historic peace agreement. And the Swedes never knew what they were doing the whole time they were there.
Wow.
But that detail was fun, but really hard. It meant an extra scene and an extra 8 minutes to explain and just pushed us too much over the edge. And we have like 12 of those.
No truth to the rumor that there was a dream ballet that you cut.
Yeah, no. That's for the movie.
So when you literally move Oslo upstairs, do you feel like it takes on a different challenge for you there?
Well, you know, to be honest, the Vivian Beaumont for me is like the greatest theater in the world because it has the perfect ratio of epic, that huge upstage area, to intimate, where the playing space is actually enormously close to the audience. In the case of Oslo, it's also a great theater to pull down a wall right there at the proscenium line and then build the set in front of that. The footprint of the Mitzi Newhouse and the Beaumont are actually not all that different in terms of pure space. So the basic transition is not so hard. The Vams are hard because the Vams at the Beaumont are very steep, so I can't swirl, push stuff on and off in the same way. Mm. So the transition is actually easier than if I had to suddenly push it into a proscenium. That would require quite a bit of rethinking. In this case, I think there's a few delicate, difficult decisions to make, but it should be pretty adaptable. And also a larger audience for that experience will be an interesting thing to go through.
And do you know that around the time when you were in college, there was talk of tearing that theater down?
Yeah. No, I know the whole history of it quite intimately. It had a rough start because they produced strange things in there and didn't know quite how to use the upstage area. They almost built a theater in the upstage area separate from the one downstage.
Right, right. Mm-hmm.
There's a whole it's quite – I think basically our attention span and our way of experiencing plays caught up with the theater, and it became better. And also improvements in sound. It's not so good for sound. So to do a play in there, you have to really be careful about the acoustics or reinforcement for the show. For a musical, it's no problem because the sound is all everybody's mic'd. But for a play, it's a little different.
So you have just the last four or five shows here: Oslo, Fiddler on the Roof, King and I, The Bridges of Madison County, Golden Boy, Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown. They all are very much different than what seemingly is you, which is like an urban New York City dweller, and you have a dramatic look into different cultures, from King and I and Fiddler on the Roof being extreme examples of it to Oslo. How much prep work are you doing into the research of the cultures here?
Well, yeah, I mean, first of all, let's look at it differently. Like, let's pretend I was a conductor and I worked in the opera, and I had to do, you know, Otello, which I've directed, or Marriage of Figaro, or they're all vastly different from each other. And what people kind of get a little bit lost in is the difference between the interpreter and the creator. The interpreter has the advantage of this beautiful pre-existing text. So if I'm good at my interpreting, I should be able to do French Molière or Gounod French or Chekhov or Wally Schwenka, which I studied in college and I've done a couple of his plays. You just become familiar with these transitions to these evoking these other worlds, which is different than if I had to write those shows. If I'm the actual writer and I'm in the creative impulse, which I separate the interpretive and creative, that job is 50 times harder, I think, and it comes from a completely different place. So, you know, that's why it's different. And in the world of musicals, there is a formula, at least an R&H formula, and one of the parts of the formula was exotic location. You know, put it somewhere like Salzburg or Siam or the South Pacific, and the people like to go where they aren't, like to go somewhere they don't know. And the job that I have is, I have to do a lot of research. I have to do a lot of work to figure out what those worlds are. But the impulse of what the text is telling me and the writing is telling me, if it's good, is actually going to make me look really smart. So, you know, it's the same thing if you do a Shakespeare and you're doing, you know, Richard III, and you have to know a lot about the War of the Roses and all this stuff. But frankly, you're always supported by the fact that the writing is absolutely off the charts of the best anyone ever did. And it really supports what you're doing.
I know you have to run, but before you go, can you just tell us about your 10 years at the Intamin?
Well, this is a very beautiful time in my life. I loved working there. I loved the space. It was a small, intimate, really beautiful thrust. It had a great upstage area. We were able to do enormous range of classical stuff. I did some new projects, like adapted this book, Nickel and Dimed, on Not Getting By in America by Barbara Ehrenreich,
great book,
which has since been produced all over the world, really. I did Light in the Piazza there. We did this thing called The American Cycle, in which we produced everything from Native Son to Kill a Mockingbird to a lot of other stuff. So I really love running a theater, because I think in those communities which thrive on it, you can play an enormous role about the community itself and about the work that goes on in them. And that's true in New York. You know, we have our kind of crazy, amazing community here of both the artists and the audiences that come to see the work. So I kind of relish it, and I really grew a lot in the same way I'd spent many, many years at the Guthrie Theater. And so all of that, I think, is an indication of, you know, vibrancy and health on the part of, you know, the country when we have a, you know, really strong regional theater presence. So it meant a lot to me. And I was actually quite influenced by Zelda Fichtin, or who just died, who brought me to the Acting Company and who sort of inspired all the best artistic directors I know. So for me, it's a kind of apostolic mission to kind of work out in the regions. It's really important.
Well, Bart, thank you so much for taking some time to talk with us about The King and I and your career and what's going on right now in the world of theater. We appreciate it.
Sure, yeah,
and
that was fun.
We look forward. We'll have you back on after Oslo opens. We'll talk a little bit about that, all right?
Yeah, that would be great. I'd love to.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
He will not always say have him say, but now and then he'll say something wonderful.
All right, with us today, we also have another special guest. Ted Chapin is with us. Ted is the president and executive director of Rodgers and Hammerstein. And we want to talk a little bit about the 60th anniversary of The King and I. So, Ted, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
So you just had a very successful run over at Lincoln Center, and we just talked to Bart Scher about the upcoming tour of The King and I. It's a very exciting time for everything over at R&H, right?
That's what we try to keep going here. You know, one exciting time after another. It's what we try for.
So tell us, what I hear that there's some new things with The King and I, that you're releasing is it a young person's version of The King and I?
Yeah, I would say from an overall philosophical standpoint, if the task here is to keep the Rodgers and Hammerstein shows alive, I think part of our task is to be aware of how times change. We discovered, for example, that the original production of The King and I, the overture started for an 8:30 curtain at 8:24, and it came down at like 11:26 because 3 hours in the theater was fine in those days. People don't want to be in the theater for 3 hours, so, you know, little nips and tucks can be made, and also, you know, overtures can be cut down. So that's sort of the kind of thinking that I think we always have to be aware of. And the idea of doing, in essence, junior versions of shows is something which I think our compadres at MTI really started it, and we've gone along with it, and it's proven to be very successful. People were fearful that if kids in grade schools got to do an hour-long versions of these musicals, they'd never want to do them in high school. And quite the reverse has taken place. If they do an hour-long version of it, they then want to know what's missing. You know, if you do The Sound of Music and there are no Nazis, we got to find out what's going on here. So that's why we're doing a version of The King and I, which will be for that world. And we've been working with our friends at iTheatrics, who are really, really smart about this. Okay. You know, what to take out and what to keep in.
Mm-hmm. However, many of the shows that iTheatrics has done for MTI involve sexuality, specifically, for example, Pippin, they just recently did a pilot program on, and a lot of the sexual nature of Pippin, where he goes on this spree, was pretty much cut out, and we expected it to be. But Rodgers and Hammerstein shows, at least the Big Five, certainly are family-friendly, and there's not much sexuality to be taken out. So give us an example of something that has been taken out, and in fact, tell me something that's been taken out reluctantly.
Well, I beg to differ. There's a quote from Oscar Hammerstein who said, there's only one thing worth writing about, and that's sex. So sex is at the core of every one of the Big Five, Rodgers and Hammerstein. It's just done in a subtle way so that it isn't, you know, everybody gyrating in front of downstage center. But I think, you know, that's sort of a quippy way, but that's Peter, you know, and Peter would always find something like that to ask about.
I wonder what that means. Go on.
The fact is the love stories that are in Rodgers and Hammerstein shows are pretty sophisticated, and they are what tends to get cut out in all of these kind of versions. But what's more exciting or more challenging is what do you keep? I mean, for example, in the King and I, you know, there is a 15-minute ballet of The Small House of Uncle Thomas in the second act. Mm-hmm. You know, if you have an hour to tell the whole story, you're certainly not going to expect fifth graders to be able to do, you know, 15 minutes of Jerome Robbins choreography. Mm-hmm. But the idea of why that dance is there, and right, the fact that Tuptim has done it in order to box the King into a corner, mm-hmm, that still remains, but in a much more simplified way. So the Luntan Tuptim, I'm not sure whether Luntan Tuptim actually made it into this version of The King and I, but if so, it's very perfunctory.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay. Now, in terms of demands that you people might make of people doing The King and I, are you going to insist that Asian groups do it, or is that not an issue at all?
Oh, Peter, go away. That's a very good and very tricky question that obviously has ramifications in the entire world of theater and world of amateur theater as well. How do you do it, and what sensitivities do you use? What we have always tried to do is to express the concerns to people who are doing these shows. You know, in the case of The King and I, things have changed. It was perfectly acceptable in 1952 for Alfred Drake to take over the role of the King for the summer. That wouldn't be okay these days. You know, what, you know, if you're going to be in Nebraska, what do you do with that? And you certainly don't put on wrong-minded makeup, but I think there should be a sensitivity, you know, basically from top to bottom about, you know, how one deals with racial differences within characters, and unless race is part of the story, you know, you can be more sensitive to, you can be, I think, wider in your view of it. I mean, there are some shows that we represent here, like the Showboat, for example, where race is very much part of the story. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you can't have an African-American chorus and some leads, then we don't encourage you to do the show at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've been here long enough that there actually was a discussion about a production in the UK that wanted to black up for Showboat. And
really?
And that,
really?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, every time we think that we're all enlightened and we've moved onward, something will tap us on the shoulder and say, maybe not quite so fast everywhere. So
have
all encouragement.
Have all of the Big Five been juniorized so far?
I think they have. We waited on the Sound of Music. The King and I is actually one of the first ones we did, but we didn't do it that well. So iTheatrics has come in and worked their magic on it. I wanted to wait for the Sound of Music because it's the one that everybody said they wanted. And I said, well, let's see if this whole thing works before we go to that one. And we did that a couple of years ago. And it's again, it's very good. You still have, you know, the Mother Abbess singing Climb Every Mountain. It is in a much more kid-friendly key, but you still get the point of what that character is saying to Maria at that point in that story, that basically, you know, is the linchpin of the story, you know, changing to go to the end of the show.
All right. Now, Carousel, of course, is always taken to task for Billy's hitting Julie. Is that something that's been excised from the junior version?
You know, I'm not sure we've done Carousel yet.
Oh, I see.
I don't think we have. I should have done more of my homework before this phone call, but I don't. I don't think, you know, I think we're that's a trickier one, I think.
I think it is. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So back to The King and I, the 60th anniversary of the film is going to be celebrated around the country, if not around. Is it international or is it just in the United States?
I think it's the U.S. I think it's North America.
Fathom Events is centralizing the way in which you can find if this is in your local theater and see it in its full glory. All 2 hours and 25 minutes of it. So you are, you know, this is another way in which Rodgers and Hammerstein is making sure that people around the country and around the world are able to continue to see great films like this by sponsoring these type of events. Mm-hmm. Is there something that you are able to tell us about this event that would entice people to see this again at a theater rather than seeing it at their on DVD at home or something?
Well, I think these movies, and this pretty much goes for all the Rodgers and Hammerstein movies, they were certainly made at a time where going out to a widescreen movie was an event. And that's how you experienced if you knew and loved Oklahoma from your either from Broadway or a touring production or a local production, and you went to the movies, you saw it big, you saw lots of corn, you saw lots of horses. Seeing them again on a big screen is always a friendly experience, because that's what the visual aspect of it knew that it was going to be on a big screen. Nobody thought about doing it on small screens, and or God forbid you that you should be able to, you know, to watch it on your computer. So the grandeur of Siam, the grandeur of that court, you know, the grandeur of Mrs. Anna and the King dancing to Shall We Dance, when you see it on a big screen, it's pretty powerful. And I would also, somebody pointed this out to me a while back, watch for the puzzlement, because the puzzlement is shot in three different sections. And in the first section and the last section, the King has an earring, and in the middle section, he does not. That's called continuity, and that's called what somebody goofed. But it's actually kind of fun to see that.
In retrospect, we almost had Frank Sinatra in Carousel. Are you glad that didn't happen? Would you like to have seen it happen? Any opinions at all?
Based on the recording that was played to me early on when I was at this office of Frank Sinatra and Shirley Jones singing If I Loved You, I think Frank Sinatra in the movie of Carousel would have been extraordinary. It was also a time in his life where he acted pretty well in movies, and I think it would have been very, very interesting. Gordon McRae is fine, it's very much of a style, and appropriate to that period and that style. But I think that Sinatra would have added something quite interesting to it. So in a way, I wish we had that, but clearly we don't.
All right. Now, we're living in an age where suddenly Allegro's popping up here, there, and everywhere. We've had it here in New York, a classic stage. There's a revival right now in England, in which I'm hearing wonderful things about. If we live long enough, might we see a movie of Allegro?
A movie of Allegro? That's a really smart and interesting idea. I think it would take an imaginative filmmaker to figure out how to do it. But since Rodgers and Hammerstein are probably guilty of putting too much imagination in the original, if there's a clever filmmaker who could take what's there and make it into the story and the show that they hoped to find, that'd be great. I'd love that idea. It had never even occurred to me.
Well, the great interest in Allegro, I suspect, has a lot to do with that wonderful two-disc set that came out a few years ago.
Ah, thank you. That was a great, that's a project of which I'm very proud, because,
well, you should.
You know, Well, we did it exactly the wrong way. We tracked the orchestra first, but imagine, and Peter, you will get this. Imagine being in Bratislava with an orchestra that doesn't speak English, with English speaking, conductor and people in the booth trying to figure out, let's make performances. Let's take a little rubato. Let's just figure this all out so it doesn't sound like a metronome is there. And when we then cast it, the performers had to abide by whatever the tracks were, and there's one big slowdown in Gentleman is a Dope, which Liz Callaway just took on as a great challenge. And it was like, oh, this is fun. This is going to be great. Mm-hmm. So it really did work out well. And it's a fun project. It was a fun project.
Okay. Yeah, even Pipe Dream has had its stay at Encores. So the one we're missing, Me and Juliet. Any interest in that? You're laughing. Any interest? Are we going to see that at Encores one of these days? I mean, they seem to do quite a bit of your stuff. So tell us.
From your mouth. I think it would be great. I think it'd be great. And I've learned as somebody who was involved with the very beginning of Encores, I've learned how. One has to be very, very careful about suggesting things without anybody feeling as if I'm trying to, hawk my wares.
Uh-huh.
It actually took Rob Berman to focus on Pipe Dream for me to get a call from Jack Bertel one day and said, "What about Pipe Dream? Rob Berman wants to do it." To which I said, "What a good idea!" Mm-hmm. So it was, it was fun. And I think that recording, stands up very well, even though it was a live recording. But I just, part of the fun of this job has been to try to be sensitive to whatever is happening and to adjust, because I just had a feeling that if we didn't grab that live at Encores, it would never happen. Exactly. To try to reconstruct it in a studio and all. It wouldn't have happened. We don't have the manpower here. There are fewer studios in New York for a whole lot of reasons. And then Scott Lehrer, the sound designer, said that in the renovation of City Center, they had upgraded the whole sound system so that we actually could take all the feeds from all the mics and put it into a hard drive and then go back into the studio and create enough of a performance so it doesn't sound like the Wallensack in the language lab at high school.
Well, now, whenever I tell people that Pipe Dream was almost done with the Muppets many years ago, I certainly get looks that say, "You're crazy." Would you verify that at least that was on the table at one point?
Yes. Here's the full story. That was actually Bruce Pomahack's idea. You know Bruce Pomahack. And he just came in one day and said, the problem with Pipe Dream was that they made the Mother Abbess the lead. There's the Mother Abbess character that sort of is in all the R&A shows, whether it's Nettie Fowler or Aunt Eller, the older, wiser woman who comes in at the right time in the story and adjusts things so that the story can then go, come to its conclusion. And he said the part of the problem with Pipe Dream is they've made that the lead, and that woman really, a facilitator can't be the lead. And he said, I was listening to it the other day, and I thought, what if that were Miss Piggy? The two people that you want to get together would be the actors, but all the other characters would be Muppets. And I thought that was a cool idea. And I actually pitched it both to Jim Henson, and I got Elaine Steinbeck on board. Everybody was like, "What?" And I said, "Well, let's examine it and see what happens." But alas, it never happened. But yes, it was Bruce's idea. And I still, every now and then, I think, I hear the song "On Our Lopsided Bus," and I just see all those Muppets back and forth on some little, bus going along the way. But it may happen at some point. But it's funny that when an idea like that, suddenly somebody tells somebody who tells somebody who puts it in print, and then it becomes part of history, because I think Ethan Morton put it in his book on Rodgers and Hammerstein that came out in the mid-80s. And so there it is for all the world.
So a couple of weeks ago, we had the sad news that Marnie Nixon had passed away. Mm-hmm. She has had such a strong relationship with R&H. I wondered if you had any remembrances to give us about that.
Well, I believe her last public appearance was at Symphony Space in April, when I was asked to do a presentation about sort of Anna Leonone's The King and I, page to screen to stage. And Michael Partantier actually reached out to me and said, could I do it with you? And I said, sure, by all means. And then he said, what about asking Marnie? She's not in great shape. But I said, what a great idea. So it was kind of her swan song. She came, she was cheered. She was very funny. A friend of Michael's had done a brilliant clip of getting to know you with the who's singing underneath very clear. Now it's Deborah Card, now it's Marnie Nixon. Uh-huh. And that one is so well done that it was really interesting to see that, because yes, you can tell if you listen very carefully, but it really blends very well. And she was great, and everybody was thrilled to see her. And she was just a wonderful, wonderful performer who for some reason, and I'm not exactly sure why, the fact that she had dubbed all those musicals became very well known, and she became sort of known as the dubber. I mean, there are a lot of other people who have dubbed movies in that era and before, and very few people know who they are, but Marnie became that person. And she was just wonderful, and it was great fun. And also we cast her as the grandma in the Allegro recording, because we figured, here is what the conversation we had, what voice is it of an older person, but clearly somebody who's musical and still has a voice. Mm-hmm. And we thought Marnie, she was actually the first person we recorded for that album. So, she was great. She will be missed.
Mm-hmm. You are keeping busy as we're wrapping up the summer, going into the fall with openings on Broadway. How involved are you with Holiday Inn?
Wearing my Irving Berlin hat. I'm fairly involved. I've been to it more than I might have been to others, partly because, it behaves like a new musical. Yes, it's an adaptation of an existing movie. Yes, it was done at good speed and it was done at the Muni. But, it's still, as you guys know, it's still, there's still tricky things about putting a musical together. And they continue. And it's almost an entirely new cast. There are a couple of people in the ensemble who have been with it all the way along. But to adjust to those talents is kind of amazing. And I think in a way, I don't want to tip my hand here, but it's kind of Bryce Pinkham's stepping up to being a leading man of the musical theater. He is ready for it. He has charm. Both he and Corbin Bleu, I have to say, they are so charming that it's going to be, I think it's going to be a bit of a revelation to people. But keep the expectation low.
It's so good to hear. We love Bryce Pinkham. We love Bryce. Yeah. And so why don't you put on your licensing hat here and talk a little bit about how excited everybody is for School of Rock.
Excited they're doing it. I got a call from Andrew. I was actually in Boise doing the tech week on the Sound of Music tour that's out there. And Andrew called and said, I want to release it to high schools right away. And it was like, okay. So, they're out there doing it.
Has that been done before?
I don't think it's ever been done before. And, it's kind of exciting. And, part of the concern that I thought when Andrew called about it is, will that undermine a potential tour? And I think the general feeling, and nobody will know until the tour actually goes out, is it might actually serve the opposite. People who have done it might want to see, since I've done it now, since I own it, I want to go and see how it's done. So I'm thrilled that everybody who's involved in School of Rock signed on to doing this, and we got it out there. And I don't know how many times it's been done, but I know it's out there, and it's keeping everybody here busy.
So when a school signs up, or a director from a high school signs up and says, hey, we want to do this, and we put in an application, and you get it in your office and you've signed off on the application, do you call somebody up and go, you're in the band?
I don't know, but it's a good idea.
I think you should do a whole big YouTube thing where you send out a camera crew and they accept. Yeah. The phone rings and you say, this is Ted Chapin from Rodgers and Hammerstein, and you're in the band, and see.
Well, and if somebody says, what? This is the wrong person.
Yeah.
What?
Well, what James just said reminds me of something else entirely. So many of us, when we hear somebody refer to a soundtrack, when they really mean an original cast album, correct. Now, when people say Rodgers and Hammerstein, do you correct them? You do.
I do. I try to be polite about it. Or actually, I got a letter the other day from someplace that should know better. There were three paragraphs in the letter. In the first paragraph, Rodgers and Hammerstein was spelled correctly. In the second paragraph, it was a Roger, R-O-D-G-E-R. And in the third paragraph, it was R-O-G-E-R-S. So very politely, I said, with all due respect, it has a D, and Rodgers and Hammerstein has an S on the end. So, what it used to irritate irritate Mary Rogers used to get extremely irritated if there isn't. That's part of why our email address is RNH, as in R and H. You know, let's just not even try to get, you know. you don't need the D.
So, and how involved are you going to be in the King and I national tour? Are you going to be out there making
sure? I'll be out there to getting it kicked off. And you know, and we're also, I mean, another little odd King and I thing that's happening now is we've been doing librettos with applause books. And, you know, when these shows were first done, Random House and other publishers would publish the librettos for the reading public. And they were all taken out of print. And then a few years ago, the people at Applause said, you know, why don't we're doing these of contemporary shows. You know, why don't we do some of the RNH shows? And so we're just about to do King and I and Carousel. We already have Oklahoma, Sound of Music, Cinderella, and South Pacific. And part of the fun of that, which I was just looking at yesterday, is there's like 12 pages of photographs in the middle. And for the King and I, we have a really cool photo to begin it, which is a photo taken by Yul Brynner on the set of the movie of Deborah Carr through gauzes. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but it's a fabulous photograph. And the back is a photograph we found from PhotoFest of Yul Brynner and Gertrude Lawrence having dinner before, in between shows, backstage at the St. James. And he's there in half costume, and she's sipping tea, and he has chopsticks. So we thought, you know, from the sublime to the ridiculous, you know, humanize this. Also a gallery of Mrs. Anna's that ranges from Barbara Cook to Elaine Stritch to Angela Lansbury to Mary Beth Peel to Marin Mazey.
All right. Now, I don't think it's impossible that you were around for the original production of Sound of Music, but I dare say you weren't around for many of the original productions of the nine Rodgers and Hammerstein shows. So as a result, if you could go back and see any one of the originals, what would it be and when would it be?
Not to think that I'm just saying this because of what we're talking about, but I think The King and I would be the one I'd want to see because – first of all, I love the show, and I think the show is really fascinating. And there are things about the original production. Jamie Hammerstein once told me that he saw it out of town, and he was so embarrassed for Gertrude Lawrence because Yul Brynner was like a force of nature. And he said to his father, you know, her name is above the title. This is kind of embarrassing, you know, because he's clearly walking away with the show. And Oscar said to Jamie, wait till we get to New York. And what he then said was, first preview in New York, she came on stage and just grabbed it. And he said, you know, she was just trying to feel her way as a star does. What's the competition on stage? Because, you know, Yul Brynner was the surprise. But once she figured out what he was all about and how he was doing his performance, she could adjust her performance. So it was a match of equals.
Well, Ted, before we let you run, I want to ask you some questions about RNH insofar as just to let everybody know the scope of how important your organization is. And you might not say that, but I want to say how important Rodgers and Hammerstein as an organization is to the world of theater. So how many shows are out there that you guys license? How many shows do you license?
You know, I used to be very up on all the statistics, and I'm not really sure where we are these days. It's also since this, I think I have to be delicate about this, but since the family sold it to this Dutch company, Imachem, with an unpronounceable name, we haven't acquired a lot of shows. So, you know, we used to acquire a few shows every year. We've acquired a couple of nice small shows, you know, but we're not doing that as much, which is kind of too bad because that was a good way to keep, you know, keep things going and keep the future going. But certainly, you know, between the Rodgers and the Hammerstein shows and the Irving Berlin shows, that's almost enough to keep everybody busy. And if there's a philosophy that I've sort of come to realize is, you know, when you have catalogs that have enough stuff in them, you can sort of keep the cycles going. You know, there's always a show that's about to emerge, and there's always a show that's sort of come to the end of that current cycle. You know, and I've now been here long enough that I've seen some of these shows cycle all the way through. And if you believe in them, and if you believe they can be done well and try to put them in hands that will do them well, I think these are kind of timeless shows. And that's, you know, that's where I appreciate you and sort of humbled by what you say, because I think, you know, we have been able to keep the shows out in circulation in different ways. Not all productions have been fabulous. I admit that. It's the theater. You never can, you know, you can't hit a home run every time. But generally speaking, I'm very proud of the of what we've accomplished and what we hopefully will continue to accomplish.
So you can spend hours on the RNH website, as Ted had mentioned, rnh.com, and see the hundreds of shows that they do represent, and all the amazing type of things that everything, all roads lead to Rome, and all musicals lead to Rodgers and Hammerstein. So, Ted, thank you so much for coming on. Thank you for so much for coming on. We really appreciate it, and we'll talk with you again soon.
It's my pleasure. Thanks, guys.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, that wraps it up for this week. Before we get on to trivia, I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com and hitting subscribe. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. You can listen to us in many ways. One of the ways is the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone or your Android device. Get us streamed to you. Broadway World Radio plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter and for Michael and for me and for Matt can be found at BroadwayRadio.com. As well as links to some of the things that we've talked about today, including the RNH website and some information about Bart. All right, so it wouldn't be a week without having our trivia. So, Peter, do you have an answer for last week's trivia?
Sure. I had asked a question that involved Time magazine, because the Donald Trump face melting and caption meltdown reminded me that sometimes Time covers are remembered for a long, long time. And indeed, I recalled one from the 60s, Is God Dead? And then I said, you know, there was a Broadway musical referenced that referenced this song. What was the show and the song? And the reason I ask this question is because over the years, faithful readers know that I give many a quiz where I quote lyrics from shows and ask you to identify them. And so many people never seem to get Celebration, a 1969 musical by Jones and Schmidt. And that's why I purposely asked the question, and I have to give my credit to Ed Glazier, the first person to get it, and Ded Popple, the second, who did recognize it as Celebration, a song called Not My Problem, where a character sings, God is dead, that's what they said, I read it in an interview. So that's the answer to last week.
So what's the new question for this week?
A musical that won two Tony Awards saw one of them perfectly describe the title of the show. What is the show and what's the award?
All right. So if you know that, email us at trivia@broadwayradio.com and we'll let you know if you're on the right track. So thanks for joining us. And on behalf of Peter Felicia, Michael Portantier, and Matt Temenini, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You have thrown me off count. No. But this is not right. Not the way I see Europeans dancing tonight.
Yes, it was. It was just like that.
No. Why not holding two hands like this?
What? No. No, as a matter of fact.
Was like this? No?
Yes.